From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Through the words of a skilled biographer, the dead can continue to inform the living. Michael Holroyd is a very skilled biographer. The first volume of his biography of George Bernard Shaw was called one of the great literary biographies of the century. On this edition of Fresh Air, The Art of Biography with Michael Holroyd. Also today, photojournalist Eugene Richards tells us about documenting an urban emergency room. There were so many victims of violence, the emergency room was nicknamed the Knife and Gun Club. Ed Ward profiles the beetle that no one remembers, Stu Sutcliffe. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Poodle Springs. It's a detective novel Raymond Chandler started 30 years ago, and now it's been finished by Robert Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Senate voted overwhelmingly today for a $9.4 billion anti-drug package. Leaders of both parties say their 2 weeks of contentious bargaining has produced an effective plan. The Senate action came after Republicans lifted the roadblock on spending measures, while they and Democrats searched for a compromise on a broad package of anti-drug programs. President Bush says the United States and its allies must do more to promote democracy in Poland. Bush today told the annual meeting of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., that the U.S. has a stake in the country's solidarity-led government, the first non-communist government in 40 years.
We understand the Polish government has under consideration a bold plan for economic recovery. And I call on the IMF and the World Bank to work rapidly with Poland to develop such a program and ensure its successful implementation. For its part, the United States intends to be out in front of this effort to take advantage of this historic development and to ensure its success.
The World Bank is holding in reserve about $250 million in development loans for Poland, mostly to modernize export-oriented food processing facilities. Poland is saddled with a $39 billion foreign debt. Stanford University researchers have some preliminary evidence that a common drug used to treat lung problems may also help fight AIDS. NPR's Michael Scholer has details.
It's hard to know if this drug will really fight AIDS or not. So far, it has only been tried in a test tube. But in that test tube, the drug keeps the AIDS virus from growing. The drug is N-acetylcysteine. NAC for short, and it's already used to treat chronic bronchitis and overdoses of some pain medicines. Stanford researchers say NAC doesn't directly attack the AIDS virus. Instead, it seems to keep the AIDS virus dormant by helping infected cells to make a protective chemical called glutathione. If it works, NAC would probably be used alongside other AIDS drugs like AZT. Researchers say patients should not try NAC on their own. Even though it has few known side effects, control tests are needed to prove it is safe for people sick with AIDS. And those tests should start soon. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
The New York Post today accused CBS Evening News of using fake battle footage and false news accounts of the war in Afghanistan. According to the Post, CBS staged footage of rebels destroying electric power lines after the rebels were persuaded to return to the scene. The story sparked a series of high-level meetings at CBS, resulting in a statement by CBS President David Berg saying he believes the network's Afghan war coverage was reported accurately. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 9 points. This is NPR News. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said today the Senate rejection of a $300 million addition to President Bush's Star Wars proposal reflects an increasing congressional sentiment to limit the program. As part of its work on a $288 billion military spending bill, the Senate yesterday refused to restore funds for Star Wars to a level closer to the amount it approved last month. The city of Denver is one step closer today to building a new airport to replace Stapleton International. Mark Roberts reports from Denver.
Department of Transportation Secretary William Skinner today approved Denver's environmental impact statement for a new airport. Skinner also gave the city $60 million in Federal Aviation Administration money to begin construction. It's believed a financial commitment from the federal government will help Denver sell bonds to finance the $2.3 billion airport project. The city hopes to begin work on the new airport next month. But construction plans could be held up. United and Continental Airlines may go to court challenging the environmental impact statement. The two airlines, which control 80% of the Denver market, would be required to help pay for the project. United and Continental argue Denver does not need a new airport. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
The Yugoslav Republic of Slovenia defied federal authorities today and declared that Slovenia had the right to secede from the country. Parliament's three chambers adopted the change to the Republic's constitution, deepening the political turmoil in Yugoslavia. The country has been shaken this year by ethnic Albanian riots in southern Kosovo, factional rivalry in the ruling Communist Party, and 900% inflation. Cuban Foreign Minister Isidoro Malamerica said today the Bush administration has begun to take steps that dash any hopes of warmer U.S.-Cuban relations. In a speech to the U.N. General Assembly, he condemned the trade embargo against Cuba, alleged violations of Cuban airspace and territorial waters, and American plans to begin television broadcast in Cuba. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A good biography is more than the facts of someone's life. My guest Michael Holroyd is one of England's leading biographers, and he sees his job as interpreting his subject's life and the times in which he lived, revealing truths that can inform our lives today. George Bernard Shaw is the subject of Holroyd's latest biography. He began the research over 13 years ago. The second in his three-volume Shaw biography has just been published. Part of the reason it's taking this long is that Shaw left behind 55 plays, including Man and Superman and Pygmalion, 5 novels, volumes of literary and music criticism, and approximately 250,000 letters. Holroyd's previous books include a biography of the Welsh painter Augustus John and the British writer Lytton Strachey, who was among the writers and artists known as the Bloomsbury Group. In 1985, Holroyd became the president of the English branch of PEN, the International Writers' Organization. Shaw, by the way, was an early member. I asked Michael Holroyd if a biographer needs to empathize with his subject.
I don't think it's necessary to identify with your subject. I don't have a beard, for example. I think that you have to be interested. There has to be some sympathy with your subject. I always see biography as a form of foreign travel, where you learn a new language, you pick up a new culture, you see a new political and literary landscape, and eventually, after sometimes rather a long journey, you come home having added something to yourself, which you hope you can give your readers.
Is there something that you feel, I'm sure there's a lot of things that you feel you've added to yourself through studying Shaw?
Yes, I have. It's been for me a life-changing book, I think, and I would certainly like it to be that for some readers, if that were possible. That would be ideal from my point of view. I've had to study a great number of things that I didn't know before. I had to work to some extent against the grain of my natural talent, and that's a risky business, but it can be an enriching business to the text, I think. And people sometimes ask me whether I like Shaw. And, in fact, I do, but that's not the basis of the biography. I'm not just trying to say to the reader, here's a jolly good chap, this is a swell guy. I'm trying to do something much more complicated. Indeed, I'm trying to pay the reader a compliment of saying, here is human nature in its relation with nature itself, if you like. And this is yesterday, and this is how it affects today. That's what I'm trying to do.
You've said that you wanted to present a new Shaw, a Shaw for our time.
Very much so, because when I started, I thought I was writing a book of cultural history. As I went on, and as we've come into the late 80s, I have realized that many of the subjects which he addressed, disarmament, medical ethics, the connection between Ireland and England, the peaceful invasion of Britain by the United States, and many other subjects, are, in fact, part of the current democratic debate. And so I have felt that it had, the book, a topical relevance that I never realized when I started it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly because Shaw had prophetic instincts, rather like his friend H.G. Wells. I see him as born ahead of his time, which made it sometimes awkward for him during his time, because he seemed very odd. But many of the things he wrote and said in his time now seem absolutely sensible and wise. I mean, his championship of women, for example, in politics, seemed quite extraordinary in the 1890s and the early part of the century. But now they are part of the current scene. And it's very interesting to plot yesterday and today in that way.
For our listeners who aren't well acquainted with Shaw's writing or his plays, where would you place him in terms of English literature, his importance?
I think he is a very important playwright. I think that he started in Britain the play of ideas. He was opposed to Victorian pantomime and simply sentimental melodrama. He saw the theatre as an extremely important forum. What happened earlier in this century was that young people came in to the theatre, listened to Shaw's plays, heard completely new ideas, and came out as modern radicals, 20th century radicals. And he used laughter as a sort of anesthetic for the operation he wished to perform on British society. He wanted to change society, to change unequal private property into commonwealth. But he didn't want to do it through bloodshed. I've called this second volume The Pursuit of Power. He wanted power through the word. He wanted writers to be able to change the mind of a country, the way people thought, and therefore the legislation.
Michael Holroyd is my guest, and volume two of his three-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw has just been published. How did you get to write this biography, which is, by the way, the authorized biography of Shaw?
Well, I was chosen to do it by the three legatees of the estate, which is the British Museum, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and the National Gallery of Ireland. And how they decided on me, I have not the slightest idea, except that they had read my previous books on Lytton Strachey and part of my Augustus John, I think. And it was on the basis of that that I was asked. And it was a great honour for me, and it was also a great terror as well, because I realised that this was a gigantic business. Shaw touched life at so many points. He believed that an author's business was to mind everybody else's business. And he, that's what he did. He minded G.K. Chesterton's business and H.G. Wells's business, Mrs. Patrick Campbell's business. He involved himself not only in the theatre, but in music and politics, but all the new scientific gadgets of the day, the wireless, the camera, the motor car. In a sense, his life is a history of the times, a cultural, political, and artistic history of the times. So it's was a bit of a terrifying prospect to me.
You know, sometimes a biographer will say with a certain amount of pride, this is the unauthorized biography of my subject, as if, you know, in the unauthorized biography they can slip in real truths, truths too powerful or too painful for the authorized biography. Did you ever feel that there would be any restrictions on you writing the authorized biography?
There have been no restrictions at all. Arrangement I had with the estate is that I could be defrocked as an authorized biographer, but there would be certain advantages to me in that. So everything was well balanced. Also, I haven't had to deal with families. I have dealt with committees, and it's quite a different exercise. Finally, I think the danger of biographers is to aggrandize their subject or fall in love with their subject. I have tried very carefully to give the opposite point of view. When Chesterton or Wells or Mrs. Patrick Campbell disagree with Shaw, I have given their best words in disagreement so people can take sides. And I have concealed very often my own personal opinion because that's not part of what was going on at the time.
Well, you say that you think it's a danger to fall in love with your subject. In fact, you've said that you think Shaw has been overprotected by those who treasure him. In what ways?
Well, I think that there is a tendency, as I say, amongst people to make a saint of the writer they particularly like in some way or other. Shaw is the saint of sometimes the lonely. people who, as I say, are out of step with their times. And although his life is a heroic story and does give comfort to people who feel they've been dealt a bad hand in life, because he played what was originally a very bad hand, he played that hand brilliantly, and also showed how every disadvantage is a potential asset in disguise. Not everyone can do that, but Shaw represents those people very well, and so they are naturally protective of him, and I understand that. But Shaw is not only for the Shavians. He is, as I see it, for the world.
Mm-hmm. What about the privacy issue? Sometimes estates or families will try to withhold certain letters that might detail intimacies that they feel would be best left unknown
to the public. Yes, I can completely understand that. I think there is a difference between a living person and a dead person. I can tell the difference quite clearly. And the difference is this, that while we are alive, we all need protection. We all need the evasions and sentimentalities that ring our lives about, and I would respect that. But when we are dead, I think that those particular protections are no longer needed. And you pay a compliment to the dead by saying that the dead can be still kept in employment for the living, and more truth can now be told. Because if we only have those evasions and sentimentalities and half-truths, then we get a completely false picture of how life is actually lived. And if we think that our role models live the sort of lives that they never did, in fact, live, we make ourselves extremely unhappy. So I would want to tell as much truth as I can find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about writing biography, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Michael Holroyd. For the past 13 years, he's been working on his biography of George Bernard Shaw. Volume 2 of this 3-volume work has just been published. He began writing biographies more than 20 years ago. He's chronicled the life of the neglected writer Hugh Kingsmill, Lytton Strachey, a member of the Bloomsbury group of writers, and the Welsh painter Augustus John. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Michael Holroyd is my guest. You know, we were talking about the privacy of dead writers who are being chronicled by a biographer. One thing that was very controversial in your biography of Lytton Strachey was that you revealed that he had been a homosexual. Were you criticized for that?
I was very much criticized, not by the family, strangely enough, but by some members of the reading public. And not only because I revealed that Strachey was practicing homosexual, but also other people were, including Maynard Keynes. Maynard Keynes, the economist, was considered, and perhaps still is considered, to be one of the linchpins of Western capitalism. So I was accused, when my book came out, of giving comfort to the enemy, of subverting our own way of life. And when President Nixon said, we are all Keynesians now, there was a sort of guffaw of laughter. sometime after that, I believe he left office. I make no claims for my biography.
Well, I guess this gets back to what you were saying before, that the dead can still be put to good use by the living in having their real lives revealed. If we know that people who had been assumed to be straight were actually homosexual, it kind of changes the view of homosexuality as this very, very minority.
And it also changes the view, really, of what is normality.
Exactly, right.
I think that there is a mainstream of human nature, and there are all sorts of tributaries in it. And there is no need for people to feel freakish or odd or part of something that's been left behind, because the narrative of life is a very broad one, and we are all part of it. And That, I hope, is one of the things that biography can do. You can pick up a biography and it can speak for you. It can say perhaps more eloquently than you can what your position in life is, what your secrets are, what your feelings, what your thoughts are. And the other thing it can do is to say, this is someone utterly unlike you, but enable you to understand that people who disagree with you, who had different backgrounds and different opinions, are not necessarily crooks or fools. So it increases your tolerance of people.
One of the things you write about Shaw is that he had a virtually sexless marriage.
Yes, but I hope I also show that he was a passionate man.
Mm-hmm.
The paradox was that he and his wife were, to some extent, lovers before they married, and not after they married. And there were reasons for that. I mean, partly he was very ill at the time of his marriage. They were in their 40s. And it soon became not part of the married relationship, sex. And he thought that people, the basis, shall we say, for a happy marriage was an intimate friendship between complementary natures, rather than simply a sexual attraction. If you married for life simply on sexual attraction, you might produce very good babies, that's one thing, but marriage would turn into a prison which you could call wedlock. And that was not a good basis for marriage. That's the point that he was also not just making and writing, but enacting in his life.
Now, how do you think that this information about Shaw's personal life changes the way we would read any of his plays, for instance?
I think it changes them a lot, and I hope it will encourage new and younger directors to stage Shaw's plays in a slightly different way.
What would be different?
I think the orchestration of the suppressed emotion, because there is a subtext, a passionate subtext to the play, which represents what was suppressed in the life. And I do believe, as I said, that he is a more passionate man than is popularly recognized. I think sometimes people think of him as having only ink in his veins and having been born with a long white beard. And I am going to try and supplant that bearded literary Superman with a recognizable human being who had a considerable vulnerability and a need to protect himself, which no longer exists.
Michael Holroyd is my guest, and he's completing a biography of George Bernard Shaw. Volume 2 has just been published. Volume 3 is still in the works. Your biographies are about Bernard Shaw. You leave the name George off, although you refer to him as GBS in the text. Why did he drop the name George?
His father was called George, and he was brought up in a ménage à trois, Catholic Protestant ménage à trois, in Ireland in the 1850s, 1860s. And the other man in the ménage à trois was also called George. And Shaw wondered for quite a time whether perhaps he was illegitimate. And that word George, which he had and which the two men in the household had, he dropped because it was a symbol of his uncertainty, his unsureness, if you like. And so he, on all his title pages, you will see just Bernard Shaw. Don't George me, he always said. He never Georged himself. But then when he became a public figure, he had this shorthand, GBS, for his public personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about your work as a biographer, I feel it's only fitting to ask you a few biographical questions about your own life. I should mention here that you are married to the novelist Margaret Drabble, who will be our guest on this program in just a few days. And I was very interested to hear that, I hope you don't mind being asked about this, but that you live separately, although you are married. And I find that a very interesting arrangement in the sense that an assumption is always made that if two people aren't living together, that somehow they're less serious in their relationship toward each other. And to be married, which is the kind of ultimate statement about your commitment to each other, and to remain living separately would be seen as a contradiction by many people.
If Margaret and I were not married, everybody would say we were living together. Since we are married, everybody says we are living apart. Both are great simplifications. We do, as it were, live together every week, but we have separate houses about 20 minutes apart. Mainly it came through accident, through work reasons. My place is full of Shaw books, hers of other books, and we kept that on. And it's worked very well, having that distance. But living apart perhaps gives too much of a remote feel to it. Let me say this, that we are always pleased to see each other. And we see each other every week.
Mm-hmm.
And we always spend sort of long weekends together. And usually, though not this time, we travel together abroad.
I'll tell you what I'm curious about. I really understand the inclination to live separately and to have, you know, private places. But I'd be interested in why you decided to get married.
It makes life
And I ask this because a lot of people get married since they will be co-owning a house and sharing possessions. It's part a legal contract in addition to a statement about the meaning of the relationship.
It was a commitment, is the first thing. It gives each other the priority. It makes life simpler. We are sort of invited out as a couple and enjoy that. What goes wrong with a lot of marriages is that people are living absolutely on top of one another. You must realize with two writers, their homes are also their offices. So we possibly spend nearly as much time together as many other people, but we are at home, which is our offices. So we both have a home and office and a home and office, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. One last question. When is volume 3 of your show biography scheduled for publication, and is it written yet?
Is my publisher listening to this, do you think? it's not wholly written, no. I've written about a third of it, it's a very difficult volume to write, but I want to try and make a case for two or three very late, unknown Shaw plays as being more modern, futuristic, and surreal, and very much part of present-day theatre. If I succeed in doing that, I'll be very pleased.
Will you be real pleased when the whole project's over?
I shall be... If I feel I've done it well, I will be very pleased, but my occupation will be gone.
You'll do another biography?
Never. I don't think I could do another one after this. This will have been over 15 years' commitment of energy, emotion, thought. I think a long holiday is what I'm really concentrating on.
a sentiment I can understand. Thank you very much for talking with us about writing biography. Thank you.
Thank you.
Volume 2 of Michael Holroyd's 3-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw is called The Pursuit of Power. It's just been published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Harvey Fierstein, who wrote and starred in the stage and screen versions of Torch Song Trilogy. It's a semi-autobiographical story about a gay man, his lovers, and his mother. The movie's out on home video. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Photojournalist Eugene Richards spent several years in and out of the hospital with his wife, who died of breast cancer. At her request, he took pictures of how she was changed by cancer and mastectomy. Several years after her death, he returned to the hospital, this time to document the action in an urban emergency room. Coming up, scenes of life and death. Also, rock historian Ed Ward expands on the answer to a Beatles trivia question, who was Stu Sutcliffe? And there's a new Philip Marlowe detective story. It's called Poodle Springs. Raymond Chandler started it shortly before his death 30 years ago, and now it's been finished by the author of the Spencer detective stories, Robert Parker. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Another former top HUD official has refused to testify before a House subcommittee investigating allegations of influence peddling, mismanagement, and fraud at the agency during the Reagan years. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
This morning, Lance Wilson, a former executive assistant to HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce, invoked his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination and refused to answer questions before a congressional panel. The committee had subpoenaed Wilson to testify about how his current employer, the Payne Weber investment firm, won lucrative contracts from HUD. Wilson also invoked a House rule that barred television and radio coverage of his appearance. Yesterday, Wilson's former boss at HUD, Samuel Pierce, invoked his Fifth Amendment rights and refused to talk. Pierce also barred the electronic news media from recording his appearance. Pierce has been subpoenaed to appear before the committee again on October 27th, and his lawyers have not said yet whether Pierce will take the Fifth at that time. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Some hurricane victims living outside of Charleston, South Carolina, say that they are missing out on shipments of relief supplies being sent to urban areas. Thousands of storm victims in the South Carolina countryside are still without power, water, food, and communications. Up to 15 of South Carolina's 46 counties were damaged by Hurricane Hugo, which officials say left a damage bill of up to $4 billion. Another U.S. city can now be added to the growing list of those restricting the sale of so-called assault weapons. Lorna Jordan from member station WVXU reports from Cincinnati.
Council approved the ban on semi-automatic weapons after hearing testimony from the police chief of Louisville, Kentucky. Earlier this month, 8 people were killed in that city by a distraught gunman with an AK-47. Earlier this year, Cincinnati City Council rejected a ban, and this time Republican Paul Booth proved to be the swing vote.
I decided to look into the semi-automatic weapons ban, not because of the situation in Louisville, but because of the ever-lingering concerns of citizens who felt the guns should be banned.
The law halts the sale of most semi-automatic weapons and requires those already owning guns within city limits to register with police. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
President Bush conceded today that security for his family has been increased, but said it was not because of any hard threat. The president said that he had no information about a report in Newsday that drug czars have threatened to kidnap one of his children unless they are granted amnesties by the governments of Colombia and the United States. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 9 points to close at 2,673.06 on volume of 159 million shares. Declining issues led advancers 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. On a recent trip to England, our rock and roll historian Ed Ward toured many musical landmarks and sites, but he says few are as moving as a tiny churchyard near Liverpool, where an early member of the Beatles is buried. Ed says that if Stu Sutcliffe had lived, the musician and painter might have become a sort of artistic director of the band.
Brighton is a small town that over the years has been engulfed by Liverpool's sprawl, which is to say that unless you're paying attention, you don't know when you're out of one and in the other. In this respect, it's like Woolton, where John Lennon grew up. And, like Wilton, Huyton has a Beatles landmark. Unlike Wilton, though, it's not on the official tour, because in Huyton Cemetery lies the body of the forgotten Beatle, Stu Sutcliffe. Stu Sutcliffe was born in 1940, just 4 months before John Lennon, and the two men met at Liverpool Art College. It was only natural. Sutcliffe was very much the beatnik, and unlike most of his fellow students, was passionately involved with ideas. He was an omnivorous reader and a person with a genuine love for art. He also dressed oddly and had a sort of James Dean aura about him, and if he hadn't been such a brilliant painter, his friends remember, he would have been expelled. He and John soon became inseparable, and when one of Stu's paintings sold for £65, he ran out and bought a bass so he could join John's group. As you can hear, if indeed that's Stu on that 1961 instrumental Cry for a Shadow, his bass playing was rough but serviceable, and he probably learned all he knew from John, who more or less idolized him. But he was good enough to stick with the band when they got their big break and went to Hamburg in 1960. There, they shared the stage at the Kaiserkeller with another Liverpool group, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, playing lots of foot-stomping music to see which band would send a member through the rotten stage first. Rory won.
Hey, all you women, don't come around unless you weigh around 400 pounds. And away from home, I don't dig shy bones. And you've got to be all right with me because of the doctors.
The Beatles liked Rory's drummer, Richie Starkey, who called himself Ringo Starr, and in fact preferred him to Pete Best, their own drummer, but they were in no shape to lure him away. One day an artist named Klaus Voormann came to the Kaiserkeller to check out the scene and was mesmerized by the Beatles. He dragged his protesting girlfriend, Astrid Kircher, down there a few days later, and she fell in love with Stu Sutcliffe at first sight. She broke up with Klaus, very amicably it seems, and was soon to be found around the Beatles, taking the first photographs of them and fixing their hair in the sort of style the German students wore, a style that soon became the band's trademark. She also whipped up some leather clothes for them to wear on stage, which gave them a distinctive look. Stu went back and forth between Hamburg and Liverpool, but in 1961 he knew he had to make a choice. Paul McCartney had never liked him and just knew he could play bass better than Stu. Stu wanted to hang out with the Exes, short for existentialists, the crowd Astrid was with, and before long he and Astrid were engaged. He also found out that the Liverpool Art College wouldn't let him back in since he was suspected of stealing an amplifier from them, a theft that was almost certainly Lennon's work. But Eduardo Paolozzi at Hamburg State Art College thought Stu's canvases were brilliant and got him a scholarship. But there was a problem. Stu was getting blinding headaches and had collapsed several times at school. He refused treatment and had periods when all went well. As April 1962 rolled around, he was looking forward to the Beatles' return to play the Star Club on the 13th. On April 10th, Astrid was working in her darkroom when her mother called to say that Stu was unconscious. She rushed to his side, but he died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, victim of a brain tumor that may have started when some thugs kicked him in the head after an early Beatles gig. Ironically, Stu's mother flew to Germany on the same plane that carried George Harrison and the band's manager, Brian Epstein, but at the airport they got in two separate cars. Hers went to the Kirschers' house in the suburb of Altona to claim her son's body. Theirs went to the Star Club, where they were due to go on in a few hours, the beginning of a road that would lead them to the top.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Photojournalist Eugene Richards has become the social visual commentator on contemporary American life, with an unblinking eye and a compassionate heart. So says Cornell Kappa, director of the International Center of Photography. For the past 16 years, Richards has photographed scenes of war, poverty, birth, and death for publications such as Life, the New York Times Magazine, and Geo. He recently documented the daily life of Denver General Hospital's emergency room, spending 12 to 20 hours a day for 3 months getting in words and pictures the horrors and heroes there. The result is his new book, The Knife and Gun Club. The title refers to the nickname that locals gave to the emergency room because of the number of violent injuries treated there. This was Richard's second extended visit to a hospital. For years he was in and out with his wife Dorothea Lynch, who had breast cancer. They even collaborated on the book Exploding into Life, which documented her illness and mastectomy. She wrote the text. He took the photographs. I asked him if it was difficult to be back in the hospital after having lived through his wife's death.
Horrible for a while. It's the strange things. It's mainly the smells. Hospital smells get you in an incredible fashion, and they sort of trigger memories. And the sounds, that muffled sound in the hallways, and the sound of the gurneys going through. So it was all for a while. It was all memories, and then the place itself in Denver took over, and it was a great relief when that happened.
What kind of guidelines did you work out with the hospital staff about what you would be allowed to shoot and when you would be in the way, or when your camera would just be inappropriate?
There was a gentleman out there, Peter Rosen, who was the director at that time. He just recently left. He's very open and a wonderful guy, but he gave the guidelines that if I was totally at the mercy of the physicians and the health aides and the nurses. If I went there and I got in the way, they would throw me out. The guidelines of the hospital were that you had to get a release on each patient. Your job was totally secondary to saving people's lives. So I did. I learned to move in a way like a ballet dancer around the most important issues.
Well, if somebody's in agony and if their life is in jeopardy, how are you going to get their permission to take a photograph?
You do it afterwards. Very often, people in a great deal of pain still can see in an incredibly bright fashion. I photographed a man who was stabbed numerous times, and afterwards he survived, thank God, and I met him later, and he says, "Oh, I remember you, you're the photographer." And I said, "How the hell can you remember me, my being there?" But he sure did.
What were your own guidelines for what would be sensationalistic or voyeuristic? There's so many opportunities for that kind of thing in an emergency room. Really, most of your photographs are not of wounds, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They're more of people's expressions than holes in their bodies.
I've got some pictures in there that I myself consider strangely borderline, and they have to be in context looked at. There's a picture of a woman. I followed a woman. It was the worst night of my life, actually, in there in this kind of a job, and because I was rooting for this person. Usually, you try not to totally personalize the person in front of you because it's hard to work. But I did with her. I saw a tattoo on her breast, of all things. And for some, I started to put a personality together. And we spent 7 hours trying to keep this woman alive. I mean, but me as an observer. And she had been shot refusing a guy a drink. in a bar. She was a waitress. And the whole night went on and on and on, and then they lost her. And I was so angry that the last photograph that I took, it's hard to say angry, I think I was sort of just, you know, kind of destroyed, that I made this picture of her laying on the table. There's nothing over her, although she looks very bloated, and there's instruments all around her. Taken out of context, I think that would be a very sensational photograph. In context, it's just simply that the doctors were done, they were a little fed up, and they walked on to another patient, and someone else's job is to come in and clean the poor woman up and present it to her family.
Mm-hmm. There's a photograph of someone who had barely survived a motorcycle accident and was at this point dying. There's kind of blood and bruises all over his body and a huge seam across his entire chest.
Well, that young man didn't, no, he didn't survive. At that moment, he was gone, and there was a minister giving him kind of...
Last rites.
He had, why that picture was in there also was in context, was because the prior patient was a young man who tried to take his life, and he shot himself, and this was his fourth attempt at taking his life, and the surgeon saved him. And the next patient was this young man who was 19 years old, very beautiful. I remember seeing a handsome face. And he banged himself in the chest after falling off a motorcycle, and he died. And everybody, even the doctors, very seldom show emotion, but they said, you know, there's just no justice in this. Because they knew the previous gentleman was going to go out and do it again. But they couldn't save this beautiful kid. So that picture is another one that's kind of rough, but it's meant to be because it's just tragedy.
You stopped photographing in the hospital because you were finally asked to leave.
Mm-hmm.
How come?
There was a political change out there. Ostensibly, it came as a result of one of my photographs that was run, fully captioned, actually, in a magazine concerning photography. And the question in the article was about journalistic ethics, whether American magazines run tougher stories than European ones. And as an illustration, they ran that big picture of the woman dead on the table that I described. And Denver picked it up, and that became a cause of the argument out there about whether or not I should be allowed in because I was portraying Denver as too tough a place. But it became in the middle of a political change, and I became kind of the first person they could get at. And I was just a photographer, just a journalist hanging out.
Was there an element of relief when you were asked to leave? And you got out, and you didn't have to go back to the emergency room the next day?
Absolutely not. I was hurt to death. I wish I could say that I really was. I was one of the few times I actually, I guess I cried. I went back to my motel room, because these were my friends. It wasn't a job anymore. These were my friends. And the thing that made it totally wonderful, despite being thrown out, is that night I spent the whole night. People were calling me all night long. Some emergency room docs called me up. Paramedics called me up. The health aide called me up, and they all said that they thought it was, you know, kind of lousy, and that we were doing something together. And it was really, it became something awful. Became rather nice.
We've been talking about the photographs in your latest book, The Knife and Gun Club. I want to ask you about the photographs in an earlier book called Exploding into Life, and these were the photos you took of your wife, Dorothea, as she was dying of breast cancer. Was it your idea or her idea to photograph her illness? I mean, to photograph her life during her illness?
Yeah, I'd like to correct you in a sense on that, because I think our book was about her living with cancer, and that was the point of it. What Dorothea had, in 1978, she came down with breast cancer, and we were looking around for material that very openly showed the nature of the disease and its treatments. And Dorothea, we couldn't find these materials, and Dorothea simply said, well, I want to, as a journalist, which she was, prepare something for other people. So we started to do this, but it became the nature of her treatments and her excitement about being alive, and that was the excitement, I think, that went through the book. The realities is that Dorothea was alive for four and a half years, and the disease came back, but she never lost that love of life, even at the very end, actually. It's Dorothea's choice simply was that she wanted every single second, and if she had to be brought back by a machine or anything else, bring me back, because I like it so much being alive that anything I get is anything I can get.
I was just wondering, you know, women are so afraid if they have a mastectomy that they'll feel really embarrassed about their bodies, and what Dorothea had done was expose herself in front of the camera, you know, her mastectomy and her bald head when she was going through radiation treatments. Did she think it was important to do that so other people would know?
She did this as time went on. It was a learning experience for her. This wasn't something, she wasn't a totally exceptional person. As a matter of fact, she was very conscious of the fact that she didn't want to come across as this. What she did is she went out with her bald head initially, and she bought a wig. The wig became uncomfortable. Then she realized that she was kind of, because she was realizing a growing strength in herself, that she was kind of proud of her bald head. And that's why the wig was thrown away. In terms of showing the breast scars, as she did in one of the photographs, that was actually a reaction to what a doctor said to her. There was a physician, a number of people came in, psychologists, and they said, well, we have to prepare you because one of the problems that you may have is a lot of women with one breast or both breasts removed suffer from the fact that they may feel like less a woman. And I remember that day very clearly because Dorothea started laughing, not to be disrespectful to the doctor, but she thought that was the most foolish thing she ever heard. She honestly did. And the doctor got very upset. And she says, you know, her words were, she says, you know, these little tits of mine are not the thing that make me what I am. And it was really true. And of course, the doctors backed off. And that's why I made the photograph. To make that point that she's laying there, there's a breast scar, but it didn't make her any less beautiful.
Mm. How often do you look back at those pictures?
I'm looking at them right now again because I'm trying to have the book published. It was published, you may not know, as a kind of photographic book by a publisher, Aperture, which was the only people who would do the book. After brought it to 35, 40 publishers, and they said, no, a book on breast cancer, of course not. Then it was published as a visual book, and now in the audience, it never reached it. It went on the stands, on those photographic stands. The women did find it because we have hosts of letters from people, especially people with cancer, which has been wonderful. But I would like to produce it now as a paperback. I'm doing it myself so that I can simply, maybe, hopefully, give it away to women's organizations and to health organizations, etc., where it really belongs.
Hmm. Do you find yourself having a different emotional response to the photographs than you did a couple of years ago?
Now it's been, since I lost Dorothy, it's been almost 6 years, astoundingly, and my response has cooled off. I can actually talk about them like I'm talking to you now, but I couldn't have done that a few years ago. I actually hid behind, I've got a tape of Dorothy speaking through her piece, and that I could show it in that respect, but there's too many memories.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, too.
Eugene Richards' new book, The Knife and Gun Club, Scenes from an Emergency Room, is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear a report about what President Bush said today about strategic arms reductions. He said there should be a strategic arms treaty, a START treaty, ready in time for his summit with Mikhail Gorbachev. Very, very positive, optimistic statement from the president. It indicates that many obstacles, evidently, are being removed to such an arms reduction treaty. We'll also hear about the Education Summit, as it's called, the conference of many governors in Charlottesville, Virginia. And we talked to two classroom teachers about what they would really like to see come out of that summit. They both tell us they'd like to see improvements in the social and economic conditions, not in the school, but in the communities that they serve.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The father of the hard-boiled detective novel, Raymond Chandler, began writing his last novel, Poodle Springs, in 1957. By the time he died, 2 years later, he'd only completed 4 chapters. Now the book also has a middle and an end. Robert Parker, who's best known for his Spencer detective novels, was chosen by Chandler's estate to pick up where Chandler had left off. Parker had devoted part of his doctoral dissertation in 1960 to Raymond Chandler's work. Critic Maureen Corrigan is a fan of hard-boiled fiction and has this review of Poodle Springs.
In Poodle Springs, Raymond Chandler transplants his detective, Philip Marlowe, from the grimy streets of L.A. to the cozy, normative world of marriage. The lucky dame is beautiful socialite Linda Loring, whose daddy sheds bucks the way a lamp sheds light. The newlyweds settle in luxurious Poodle Springs, Chandler's contemptuous nickname for Palm Springs, but trouble dogs Marlowe even in paradise. Linda wants Marlowe to spend his days with her, drinking gin gimlets beside the pool. But Marlowe won't let himself become a kept man, so he opens up a CD detective office on the edge of town and begins working for Manny Lipschultz, a club owner who's being threatened by the mob because... Well, that's where Chandler's Poodle Springs stops and Parker's picks up. Chandler left almost no clues behind as to how the marriage or murder plots would develop. Nevertheless, Robert Parker has done a terrific job of finishing Poodle Springs, 30 years after Chandler stopped trying. Usually, literary fragments are best left alone. I'd rather have half a Kubla Khan than the whole poem completed by a Coleridge imitator. But Parker does more than mimic Chandler here. He updates him. And in this collaboration, Chandler and Parker have solved some of each other's worst writing problems. Surely one reason Chandler was working so slowly on Poodle Springs was that he was having trouble imagining a married Marlowe. But as readers of the Spencer novels know, Parker has licked this problem of how a hard-boiled detective can be autonomous and intimately involved. He manages to create a lasting relationship for Marlowe that doesn't compromise his essential solitude. In turn, Parker's writing benefits from his close study of Chandler. The last few Spencer novels have been rather short on plot and long on recipes and psychobabble. But in Poodle Springs, Parker constructs an ambitious plot featuring dead blondes, sleazy photographers, overprotective fathers, and a bigamist who's Marlowe's nightmare vision of himself. Parker also has fun here concocting Chandler-esque metaphors like, the office bottle was still there. He was gazing at it the way a cow looks at a meadow. Or, Eddie smiled. The effect was of light passing over a flat stone surface for a moment. The surface never changed. Don't get me wrong, Poodle Springs isn't the Big Sleep. But by 1957, Chandler wasn't in any shape to write the Big Sleep either. Poodle Springs is a good read. It also represents the only smooth collaboration of Chandler's career. Chandler described his collaboration with Billy Wilder on the script of Double Indemnity as an agonizing experience that's probably shortened my life. No danger of that here. This post-mortem collaboration on Poodle Springs brings out some of the best that Chandler and Parker have to offer.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Poodle Springs by Raymond Chandler and Robert Parker is published by Putnam. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air. We had research assistance from Mima Spadula and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Harvey Fierstein compares his real life with the story he told in the play and movie Torch Song Trilogy. Also, we listen to Sukus music from Zaire and review the movie Tom Jones, which is back in theaters again. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.